So this morning I wanted to talk more about metta and metta bhavana, the practice or the cultivation of loving kindness, and say a few words about what we're really talking about, because sometimes the idea of metta or love can seem almost naive or simple or even preliminary to the path. You know, maybe you want to talk about dependent origination and go really deep into the Dhamma. And yet actually love is something very profound when we're talking about real loving kindness. It's quite an exalted practice. And yet it's something that we already have a sense of in our own hearts as human beings. You know, we have this innate capacity to love. And I think all of us to some degree know what it means to love, at least in some way. Of course, we can't even be here unless we've received a lot of love in our lives, although it may have been, you know, sometimes mixed with other emotions. Sometimes even the love of a mother to her child or a father to their child is mixed with expectation, irritation, you know, even sometimes hate. And yet there's still something there that gives us a sense of what it's like to care for another or be cared for by another. And there are many different types of love. I was just reading a little bit about Greek philosophy, reflecting and refreshing my memory. And they have four main kinds of love. One is called storge, maybe it's pronounced wrongly, and it's a kind of dutiful love that somebody might not feel particularly loving, but it's a kind of love that performs its duty, you know, looks after others. And then they have a kind of brotherly love, which I quite like the sound of, and that is the kind of love that we find in platonic relationships with our friends, with our family. We look out for one another, and that's called philia. And I was wondering if it might have some connection to the word affiliate. It might not, but I'd be surprised if it didn't, because the limitation with that kind of love is that it still remains in its circle. You're loving because this is my brother, my sister, my parent or friend. And it's not extending itself as far as real loving kindness would extend. And then they have, of course, eros, which is the sort of romantic or sexual kind of love. Apparently eros is the Greek god of romantic love, and the Roman god is Cupid. So some of us might be more familiar with that. And that's unfortunately often what we really take as love in our cultures and societies. You know, we sometimes equate love and lovingness to a feeling, which is actually very heavily attached, and it has a lot of affection but also a lot of stickiness. And it's not to say that real love is not also present in that case, but it's not enough in and of itself. I read some research a while back that said that when a couple fall in love, of any gender, for the first few years, you know, they get the butterflies, they get this wonderful feeling of exhilaration around each other. But then, if they don't have a child within about 3 years, that starts to wear off. It's a chemical reaction that starts up, and it's due to lots of different things. It's not only compatibility. Sometimes it's just actually the smell of the person. It's like that kind of primal in a way, right? There's just something about that person you can't even put your finger on that is causing an attraction. But if there isn't something deeper to keep you together, that will actually fade in time. So having a child, of course, is something that can channel that love into something a little bit purer and more meaningful and can help that love to grow. And of course, where there's a deep friendship also involved among partners, then that love has some foundation on which to stand. And then finally, in the Greek classification of love, they have something called agape. It's spelled like A-G-A-P-E. And they call that the kind of love that a real God, okay, maybe most of us are not Christian here, but a perfect image of a God would feel towards all fellow human beings, towards all human beings, and hopefully animals too. And it's a much more charitable, benevolent kind of love that doesn't have high expectations or demands, but just gives of itself. So they call this a kind of love that's close to charity. And I think this is what the Buddha's talking about. He's talking about a love that gives of itself. And with the practice of loving kindness, we can even go beyond the idea of self and of other, of giver and receiver, to something that's just a state of mind. So what we're trying to do with metta bhavana, with the cultivation of loving kindness, is to start from where we are, start with the love that we have, that we know, that we recognize in our heart, and that keeps us connected to one another. But to elevate that, to purify it of its impurities, like attachment, sentimentality, expectation, even kind of possession, control. And not only to elevate it, but also to extend it to all living beings. So in the Metta Sutta, the Buddha said it's the kind of love that a mother has towards her child. The exact words which we chanted today are, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. But that's not enough, right? I don't know how many mothers or fathers we have in this room. But the next line is important. It's this kind of love extended to all living beings. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should we cherish all living beings. So it goes beyond this idea of me and mine, of self and other, to all. And one of the ways that you can cultivate metta to the point of deep meditation is actually to lose the perception of beings altogether, and just to disembody that love. The love becomes disembodied, it becomes a state of mind. And when it reaches and spreads universally, the idea of self and other, of different people, all that diversity of perception disappears, and you come to a state of what I would call oneness, what Ajahn Brahm calls nonness. So the idea of many is the same as one, it's also the same as none. People, beings become indiscriminate, and the love just spreads all around. So this is, of course, we're talking about the sort of higher end of loving kindness. But first of all, just looking at the practical aspects of love, I like the word love personally, because I think that word's been corrupted and kind of tarnished by what we really refer to as kind of attachment. But real love is the love that frees. It's the love that allows a person, allows ourselves, to be just as we are, and also has another's best interests at heart. So one of the most beautiful examples of loving kindness in my life is from my own teacher, Ajahn Brahm. I've been very blessed, because even before that I had a very wonderful preceptor in Myanmar, and I experienced some of what it means to receive loving kindness from them too. They were an embodiment of love. And what I've noticed is this commitment, which might be close to the word storge, the dutiful, committed kind of love, a commitment to a person's well-being and spiritual growth, which persists throughout challenges and difficulties, and only wishes for another person's well-being, welfare, and spiritual growth. This is, of course, the highest, most exalted kind of love, and this is the love that the Buddha had for his disciples. He wasn't attached. He didn't expect anything back. He didn't feel kind of betrayed if they decided to renounce the training. But he just came from this place of pure loving kindness that wished only the best for all those beings he encountered, and that was founded on an understanding of suffering. You know, realizing that all beings suffer due to their own delusions, or maybe sometimes due to the conditions that they find themselves in. And, you know, those conditions limit our choices, limit our options sometimes. So sometimes we don't have the opportunity to be around good spiritual friends or hear the Dhamma. How can we be expected to practice and to cultivate these beautiful qualities in our heart? And the Buddha knew this. So his way of expressing love was to teach the Dhamma to anyone with little dust in their eyes, anyone who had an opportunity to understand, or who might have an opportunity to understand. He didn't give up on anybody. He didn't think, this person's a prostitute, they'll never understand, their sila's so bad, or this person's actually a murderer. And these were real people in the Buddha's life. There was a courtesan called Ambapali. I think she was born like on a lily pad or something like this, and she was just grown up basically in the streets, and then she became, she was very beautiful and became a courtesan, and, you know, basically offered her body to all these rich people and kings and whoever. So you could say, oh, that's, you know, not really correct according to ethical standards, but the Buddha didn't see that. He saw somebody who was suffering and somebody who was keen to hear the Dhamma. Similarly, there was a mass murderer called Angulimala, which means something a bit grim, like a necklace of fingers. So mala is like a garland or a necklace, and Anguli is like a finger. And this Angulimala had actually, I suppose, had a misinformed kind of devotion and love to his teacher. So be careful of fake gurus. And his teacher actually asked him to go and kill 1,000 people and bring back their fingers around the neck. And because of his misplaced devotion, he actually did that. And it came to, of course, all stories come to this, you know, final moment where he was about to kill the 1,000th person. And the Buddha realized it and decided to go and find Angulimala and bring him to his senses. So using his kind of powers of perception and the divine eye, he surveyed the world and found that, you know, this person was in danger of committing even more atrocious murders, and went out and found Angulimala and used his psychic powers to walk really fast. So Angulimala was coming after the Buddha now, thinking, this is my 1,000th person. And the Buddha decided to use his psychic powers to walk extra fast. So no matter how fast Angulimala ran, he couldn't keep up with him. And then eventually the Buddha, he kept shouting to the Buddha, stop, monk, stop. And the Buddha at high speed said, I have stopped. You stop. And this was enough to stop Angulimala in his tracks. And shortly after that, he took the ordination and became completely transformed. So this was the power of loving kindness. The Buddha was willing to potentially sacrifice his life, but of course with no real regard for his own physical bodily existence, and also knowing that he had the capacity to bring this person around, he went after Angulimala and transformed his life. And after that, he became the patron saint of pregnant women, believe it or not. And Angulimala would be called in whenever there was a difficult childbirth to chant blessings for the pregnant woman so that she would deliver safely and be well. Yeah. So this is the power of the practice, to transform even the most hardened criminal that we might assume, you know, cannot be changed. So this is some of the potentials of loving kindness. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about the goal of loving kindness. Again, referring back to the Metta Sutta and the very first sentence there, which only really occurred to me recently, but I looked at this first sentence and it says very clearly, for one who is skilled in their own welfare or in goodness, in kusala, this is how to attain the path of peace, to practice loving kindness. So the Buddha's teaching loving kindness not just so we feel better, not just so we have more friends, right? Or even so that our heart is open to the world. You know, and we come out of discrimination, we come out of anger and ill will. But he's actually teaching us loving kindness because it's a powerful path to peace. And that state of peace means Nibbana itself. It means full liberation. And metta is a particularly joyful path to take towards that liberation. Even if you don't take it as your main vehicle, it's important to make much of it, to include it in your daily practice, and to really use it almost as a measure of progress, not in the sense that you're looking for results. You know, metta, loving kindness, is giving without expecting anything in return, even the results of loving kindness. But the heart should be softening, the heart should be opening. We need to check that we're becoming more empathetic towards other human beings. We have more understanding of other human beings. We're not becoming self-interested and focused on me and my progress. Yeah, this is very important. And for me, in my practice, I've always sort of avoided that tendency by serving as well as practicing meditation. So I would really encourage everybody in this room, if you find benefit in the practice, go out and serve somebody else. Find ways to offer other people the opportunity for what you've received. So if you've received something from this retreat, even a little something, even tools that you'll apply later, think about doing that for another. You know, think about all those beings that might benefit if only they knew there was this opportunity. So this is a way to express loving kindness through action, and it stops the practice becoming dry. One of the difficulties for long-term meditators is the practice can become a bit dry, a bit flat, a little bit brittle. And I have some, I guess they won't mind me saying this, but I have some monk friends in America, and they're young, fairly young monks, and they've been in robes quite a long time. And they're doing a great job, actually, of developing a community near Seattle. And they just managed to, or almost managed to get some land to start a forest monastery. And they chose to leave the Wat Pa Pong tradition, which is the Thai forest tradition that didn't agree to the ordination of bhikkhunis, to the full ordination for women, at least, you know, at the top levels. It's made it very difficult for the associated branches. So these two monks decided they don't want to be affiliated. So they sacrificed, out of loving kindness, some of the benefits and privileges that come from being part of the gang. And they've gone solo so that they feel free to support bhikkhunis. And this is great, you know, because obviously we need allies. We need to come together. We need to have fellow feeling concern for people of all genders, not only our own gender. So I was already quite interested in what they were doing. And then I was speaking to one of the monks there, and he actually said another benefit for him in leaving that tradition is that he can be more creative in his practice. He said he's seen too many monks, friends of his, who've literally dried up over time because, you know, it can be quite an austere lifestyle. We don't eat after 12. You know, we don't sleep that much necessarily. There are lots and lots of don'ts. And if you're not starting to enjoy and cultivate and generate really beautiful, moist, soft states of mind, you can become a little bit brittle. It's like anything. If you have a passion for something like music and it becomes your livelihood, you have to work for it and it now becomes a living, it could lose some of its joy. It could become like, oh, am I going to be creative enough? I have to push myself. I have to work really late because I'm depending on this as my livelihood. And the same thing in monastic life, you know, people expect you to be a good meditator, to show up happy and inspired, right? And if you're not finding that joy from inside, it can be difficult. You can actually start to feel quite conflicted and even, you know, have a sense of incongruence between the way you present and the way you feel. And I've pretty much avoided that by finding a lot of joy in service and a lot of joy in practices like loving kindness that really open the heart and that also offer a lot of self-soothing, you know, because we have to be resourced within. So this practice leads towards peace when we can really start to embody it, when we can really move beyond the realm of concepts and ideas around love and start to get in touch with the feeling, the meaning of love, and actually put that into practice in our lives. Yeah. And there are so many benefits. I'm going to run out of time, which is so frustrating because I haven't really started the main part of this talk. But I'll skip to the benefits and then you'll be inspired to practice. So the Buddha said that some of the benefits are very simple benefits that you might think are no big deal, but that actually contribute to a life of happiness. So three of the first benefits are all around sleep and rest, resting the mind. Sometimes we're so overwrought, we're so stressed out from the modern lifestyle. Although I'm not sure about in Finland, because I asked you last night if you're tired and nobody said that you were. I was thinking, this is strange. Is it just that you don't realise you're tired yet? Or has the Finnish culture just got something really down to a T? Maybe it's the saunas and the lake plungers.
Mm.
Yeah, maybe because you get into the ice from time to time. I don't know. But the Buddha said that one of the first benefits is that you go to sleep easily. You know, you're not lying there at night kind of tossing and turning, wondering if you've spent your day well. You just sleep easily because, you have a clear conscience and you feel at ease in yourself. You can also spread loving kindness to all beings before you go to bed. And then you also sleep deeply. You don't have bad dreams. If anybody had a bad dream, it doesn't mean you don't have enough loving kindness. It just means that the practice is highlighting those obstacles and those places that love has yet to reach. That's all. It's just making you more aware of the subconscious layers of your mind. So don't worry about this. I still have really strange dreams sometimes. And I would say I cultivate quite a lot of loving kindness. But the mind is very complex and very dynamic sometimes in our sleep. But nevertheless, you'll wake up feeling refreshed, the Buddha says. And even better than that, if you practice a lot of loving kindness, you'll die unconfused. Because you're keeping that clarity of mind. Love always goes along with mindfulness as well. The practice of metta involves a lot of mindfulness, a clear steering of the mind towards the emotion of loving kindness. Another massive benefit that the Buddha points to is our enriched relationships. So loving kindness is good for having lots and lots of friends. And you might not be intimate with all of your friends, but there's a sense that everyone is or could be a friend. You feel feelings of friendliness very easily towards beings. You can see something of yourself in all beings. You know, our humanity, our shared humanity. Yeah. And this brings us together. There's a little bit of research. I don't know if I can read in this light, but I read it recently and it talked about, so this was from an article in the Nature Human Behaviour magazine a couple of years ago, and it's saying that social disconnection triggers the same response in the brain as physical pain, which is very interesting. You know, and I think our societies, our cultures really suffer from this, you know, this feeling of social disconnection, especially after COVID. I mean, I was disconnected from a real person for nearly 2 years. And I had all my lovely friendly faces popping up on Zoom, but actually not being able to see, look in a person's eyes, touch another person, and just feel that kind of companionship really had an effect on me. After about a year, my nervous system got dysregulated. And I started to have actually a lot of anxiety coming up, which has never been really something that's happened to me before. I can be a little bit nervous, but not actually anxiety attacks. And I attribute this mainly to feeling that social disconnect. Because since the COVID restrictions lifted and I started to meet people again and meet a lot of people and have a lot of good companionship, I've never had anything like that sort of anxiety again. So this just shows how important it is to have meaningful relationships in our life and to reach out to one another, sometimes to ask for help, even if you don't think you need it. If somebody offers help, just say, sure. It's an opportunity to work together on something and to share the energies of your life with another person. The other thing that I found in the research from Frontiers in Psychology last year is that spiritual connection. And that means whether through faith or through meditation or even just sharing meaningful work together, meaningful life purposes with other people. Spiritual connection actually lowers cortisol levels. Can you believe it? It's quite obvious, isn't it, right? Apparently saunas do the same thing, but that's not enough on its own. Spiritual connection in the sauna, maybe that is that. building it up. And also emotional resilience, enhances emotional resilience to have this sense of spiritual connection with others. And this reminds me of the Buddha's teachings on developing a soft mind. Have you heard this teaching before? Yeah, so one of the ways he describes the mind after becoming free from the five hindrances, and in particular with metta practice, it's very powerful for overcoming ill will. He says it's like purifying gold. So what we're doing with the practice of samadhi or the practice of loving kindness, which can lead to samadhi in a powerful way, is we're purifying the mind from impurities, so to speak. And those impurities, according to the Buddha, are what he calls the five hindrances. Ajahn Brahmali calls these public enemy number one to your meditation. So these five rogues that live in the mind. But luckily they're just visitors. They don't actually live there. They're just, you know, passing through, so don't worry about it. So the first one is sensory desire, yeah, sensual craving, which is kind of creates a lot of discontent, yeah. And it's also a reaction to the unpleasant. It's kind of the other side of aversion. Craving and aversion, they kind of dance around each other. The second one is ill will or aversion, anger. It can extend even to things like boredom, slight irritation, mild kind of, what's the point? Does that sound familiar to anyone? So this is on the side of aversion. And loving kindness is really powerful in overcoming this. And then the next three hindrances are kind of extensions of the first two, the craving and aversion. Basically, liking and disliking, trying to push away things we don't like, trying to pull towards ourselves things that we like. And you can see this push-pull dynamic happening in our minds, even in very subtle ways in the meditation. You know, you have some joy coming up, ooh, you kind of lurch towards it. It's like this hand comes out, wants to grab the piti, the happiness, and then lo and behold, it recedes. Or you have this sort of slight kind of wariness, you know. It can be so subtle. You're just watching the breath and you're like, I'm watching you, okay. Are you changing? Are you becoming more peaceful? Not sure about this. Do you recognize this? Or there's an emotion and you're like, okay, I'm making peace, I'm being equanimous, I'm sitting here with restlessness. If I sit here long enough, you'll go away. You're actually not embracing it. So these next three are like drowsiness and dullness, let's call it. So physical kind of inertia or physical kind of sluggishness and mental dullness. Restlessness, they also go together. One minute you're sleepy, you drag yourself out of bed and then you feel a bit restless. And then because of the restlessness, you get sleepy again. And then the last one is doubt, which is, I quite like the simile of being lost in the desert. Because it's not just not knowing, it's kind of being confused, being lost, not really knowing what you're doing or not really having clarity that's helpful to the practice. It's like the mind's becoming a little bit dull again, it's zoning out. And this can happen as well because you're not really enjoying things. You know, you're not really finding meaning in what you're doing. Or you're not really clear on the teachings. Yeah. So these hindrances make the mind hard. They make it brittle and dry. And we approach our meditation kind of trying to fix ourselves or trying to kind of overcome these things, but not really with a heart of openness and curiosity. So when we practice loving kindness, it's very powerful right at the outset for aligning ourselves with right motivation, which is the second factor of the path. The first factor, right view, is understanding in brief. I can only go in brief now. Understanding that all beings suffer and suffering is universal. Right? No matter who we are, no matter what our life circumstances, inevitably suffering is a part and parcel of our day-to-day life. And it's universal. There's nothing wrong with us because we feel suffering. This is just the condition we're born into. And our actions have results. So sometimes out of delusion, we reinforce the suffering. We create more suffering because we choose unskillfully in life. You know, we have unskillful actions of body and speech, and unfortunately we create more suffering for ourselves as a result. And for someone who really starts to see this and see the universal nature of the problem, the automatic response is to have loving kindness and compassion towards beings, towards ourselves and towards others, because we're kind of swimming in the sea like a little bit lost and we're just trying to stay afloat. The Buddha says all beings desire happiness and recoil from pain. All beings, no matter human or animal, or even the tiniest insect. You'll never see an insect going, yes, yes, please squash me. You know, you only ever see insects running away, right? Trying to get out of the way of pain. So, of course, they suffer too. They feel pain. So the natural response is that we become more compassionate, more caring, more loving. And this informs our behavior of body and speech. As we said last night, if you have a motivation of loving kindness, then your actions of body and speech are going to be much more harmless. We can't be completely harmless in the human realm. There's going to be some way that we're harming other beings. Even if our intentions are perfectly pure, even the Buddha had enemies. Can you imagine? Even the Buddha upset people. Not intentionally, you know, and there was no bad karma ensuing from that. But there's no way that living, you know, together in societies or even alone, we cannot cause some harm, but we minimize it as best we can. And also through our life, livelihood, right? So I'm going through the Eightfold Path in brief and showing you how metta runs through it like a river. One of my friends said, yeah, it trickles through, doesn't it? It trickles through everything. I said, no, it gushes. It gushes through the whole path. The metta is just all-encompassing. And so it's specifically mentioned in the right motivation as non-ill will. So because we have this foundation of sila, we have the opportunity to start going in and start looking at the way we use our mind. And so another part of metta meditation is actually developing wholesome states. And that is part of right endeavor. My teacher Ajahn Brahm likes to call right effort, right endeavor. Because it's not that you actually need to use force. It's more understanding how to cultivate the wholesome and prevent the unwholesome from invading the mind. And one of the really lovely similes he uses is that it's like inviting all these wonderful friends into your home. So in the same way, we invite all these beautiful states into our mind. So in order to invite them in order to invite your friends into your house, you make the atmosphere really nice. You put on maybe a log fire. You put out some cakes. You maybe put out some juice or some Earl Grey tea. Actually, my new favourite tea is biscuit brew. Yorkshire tea biscuit brew. I don't know if you get any over here. I'll have to send some to Finland. It's really good. You've tried it.
Yeah, it's good.
So you put out the biscuit tea and there's no biscuits in it. Okay, somebody asked me, is it allowable? Because they thought it might be made of biscuits. Anyway, it's just tastes of biscuits. So that invites all the good people into your house. So in the same way, we prepare our mind by, you know, developing virtue, developing gratitude, contentment, all these beautiful qualities in our mind, and then we invite loving kindness inside. And just as when your house is full of friends, the lights are on, it's obvious people are home, the burglars can't come in, right? Who's going to go into a house that's obviously full of people and there's a party going on and everybody's happy? You know, you can even hear the Metta Sutta being chanted coming out of the the windows and the doors. So you're not going to have those enemies invading your house. And in the same way, it's very, very difficult for the unwholesome states of aversion or restlessness to come in if you have lots of loving kindness inside. So this accomplishes right effort. And it also dispels the enemies from your home. You know, they just can't stay there. If there's too many good people around, they just kind of go to the corner and, ooh, it's not my place. And they disappear. That's what Mara used to do. Mara in the suttas was the personification of all our negativities, all these afflictive emotions. And as soon as the monk or the nun would see Mara and say, Mara, I know you. In other words, mindfulness, awareness, clarity was stronger than Mara. Mara would slink away with shoulders hunched, ooh, head drooping. Oh, the nun knows me, she knows me. And Mara would slink away. So in the same way, these unwholesome states won't stand a chance if you're full of loving kindness. And with this, these beautiful qualities in our mind, we have the opportunity to develop very clear mindfulness. Because mindfulness is never clear. It's never bare awareness as long as these unwholesome states are still distorting the truth. You know, have you ever noticed that if you're feeling, let's say, pissed off with someone, you can only see the irritable things about that person, right? And if you are careful and you restrain yourself at that time, quite often you're really relieved afterwards, because then you realize, oh, actually, this person's just going through a hard time. Or actually, this person just offered me a cup of biscuit brew. And if I'd have made a fuss that they were making a noise in the kitchen, then, oh, actually, they were doing it with loving kindness for me. And you feel relieved, right, that you didn't kind of get irritated with that person. So we don't see things as they are when we have ill will in our mind. Similarly, when there's lust or attachment or, you know, a sense of wanting to control a person, expecting them to be a certain way to meet our needs, we're not seeing the person for who they are. We're seeing them as a kind of objectification of our wants and needs. So it's not to condemn ourselves for this, but it's just to start not believing that what we see is really true, as long as we still have the five hindrances operating in our mind. Just give yourself, give the other person the benefit of the doubt. Recognize that, okay, right now there's restlessness, right now there's ill will, and find the remedy for that. So the remedy, again, is a beautiful one for this retreat. It's the remedy of loving kindness. And as the mindfulness develops, you know, in a very clear and sustained way, it gives rise, or let's say it allows us to sink in more fully to our experience in the moment and deepen samadhi states. So samadhi is sometimes translated as serenity or sustained awareness. So it's a continuity of mindfulness. And at its deeper levels, I suppose my preferred translation now is Ajahn Brahm's, the word stillness, where the mind really settles down. And that's like a lake, not with this sort of bubbling water coming up, but a lake that's completely tranquil and still. So still that the surface is just like glass. And you can see deep down under the water to what's at the bottom. You can see through the whole mind in a way you've never seen it before. And it's free from those hindrances at this time. And that's what the Buddha referred to as a soft mind. He said the mind at that time is like gold that's been purified of all the impurities, like tin, copper, brass, whatever else is mixed with the gold. Now you just have pure gold, and you can use that gold. It's liquid, so you can bend it to any shape you wish. If you want to make bracelets, you can make bracelets. If you want to make a jog, you can make a jog. In the context of meditation, you can direct the mind towards the truth of non-self, if you wish. If you wish, you can try to understand the five aggregates, try to understand the nature of the body, the mind. If you want, you can direct it to even more loving kindness. You can spread loving kindness in every direction, in all four directions. So at this time, the mind is unbiased, it's malleable, which means soft. The word is mudu in Pali. And it also has this ability to sustain itself on a particular area of existence for long enough to really penetrate, to really see deeply in ways you've never seen before. And metta can lead to these states. The four Brahma-viharas. Do you know the word Brahma-vihara? Yeah? Divine abodes, which are basically metta, loving-kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity develop to a depth. These are equivalent to the four jhanas. So these are the same as those four deep states of meditation, but they have their particular flavor. So after going deeply in metta, you know, into samadhi with the flavor of metta, you will come out of that state of mind, or that however deeply you go, I don't really like to talk about them as states of mind, it's like degrees of stillness, yeah, degrees of calm. You'll come out and there'll be a flavour of loving kindness informing the way you regard the world and other people. Sometimes it's almost as though the whole world looks soft. People look friendly and fluffy, and the teddy bears look even fluffier than they were before. And you start to see people sitting there with teddy bears and stroking them, and you think, what sort of retreat is this? So this is one of the benefits of loving kindness and the potential of loving kindness. So I hope I've indicated just how far it runs through the whole path. So I wanted to talk just a little bit for another 5 minutes about how we're going to approach loving kindness in this short retreat. And of course, again, the correct approach is key. So remember, when you're practicing meditation, whether it's loving kindness or any other kind of meditation, we're practicing for the sake of practicing. We're practicing because it's a beautiful, noble thing to do. We're offering our time to the Buddha, to the path, for the benefit of all living beings. So we're motivated by kindness. We're motivated by a wish to give to ourselves, give to other beings. It doesn't matter whether we receive immediate results or not. This is not why we practice. Loving kindness is loving, giving without expecting anything in return. So yes, loving kindness will lead to a lessening and eventually an abandoning of ill will, but it's not the reason we practice. We practice to give, and that is a result. So don't worry about it if you have, you know, ill will coming up. It's great. You're starting to notice where the blockages are, and you have an opportunity to develop a wholesome relationship with that ill will, with that aversion in the heart. So it's a win-win, basically. We're going inside to notice the condition of our mind and to start to learn to develop a proper relationship with it. So we're going to use phrases. We're going to use words and phrases that become a sort of foundation for the mind to get the metta going. And this is an approach used in the Visuddhimagga, which is a commentary to the suttas. And it goes through different categories of beings. And the simile Ajahn Brahm likes to use is that each category is like a different type of kindling for the fire. So we want to build a fire. And when we start a fire, we have to use small twigs, first of all. You can't just put the big logs on the fire straight away. So in the same way, in the beginning, we take an object which is easy. That means we think of a person who is easy to love, what we call the loved person or the friend or the teacher, the benefactor. So somebody who you find it very easy to have thoughts and feelings of loving kindness towards. And we just bring this being to mind. So that's like the kindling. And then we start to repeat phrases of loving kindness, as we did last night, just shortly at the end. May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be at peace. And these can be unique to you and to the person. So please choose what's meaningful for you. Don't just say something that you've read or something that I've said if you don't feel connected to that particular phrase. You might wish this person contentment. You might wish them ease. Yeah, make it simple. Don't wish them a good job in such and such an organization. That's not, that's too specific, right? But just general wishes for their well-being, their safety, their health. And we say these phrases, we offer them as gifts, and then we listen to the resonance in our heart. So it's a kind of balance between technique, between discursive thought and emotional intuition. And we have to find that balance for ourselves. So for some of us, we'll want to just keep repeating the phrase, and that becomes the kind of object, the main object of our meditation. And this is already fantastic, because by doing that, you're basically substituting any possible thought of ill will or cruelty. It simply cannot arise. So you're purifying your mind and you're practicing right thought and right effort, right endeavor. And over time, that's going to start to point the mind towards the feeling of loving kindness. Some people are more visual and they might be able to bring up the image or the impression or even the feeling of the person in front of their mind. And that will be the main stimulation for the loving kindness. It's still advisable to use the phrases from time to time, just to keep the mind directed on what you're doing. But for some of you, you might be able to, or you might wish to have longer spaces between each phrase. And you might start to really feel the loving kindness developing around the heart. I'm sort of pointing to this area. Sometimes it's spread throughout the body. Sometimes it's just a sense of ease that you start to sense, or feeling of tingling in the hands. The hands are very easy places to be with. And again, just bring up the phrases from time to time, and then allow the mind to move towards the experience of loving kindness. Just trusting that what you're doing, the intention is enough. So does this make sense? Yeah? Great. So today we're going to start, at least in this session, with a loved person, and we can continue with the loved person for most of the morning. Because I found, especially teaching in, I don't know about Asian countries, I've mostly taught in non-Asian countries, but I have a feeling that in Asia people have less self-criticism, and it's easier for them to start with themselves, whereas over here, perhaps in Finland too, I don't know, but in England certainly, yeah, you're putting your thumbs up. It's harder to have loving kindness towards ourselves than it is towards a loved person. So we just start from where it's easy. We use that kindling first of all, and later we'll add other beings to the fire of loving kindness. Okay?